All right, thank you very much. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you. Thank you for responding. I appreciate that. I am your chair. My name is Malia Cohen. I'm the state controller, and I want to welcome you to our regularly scheduled State Lands Commission meeting. It is August 25th, 1 o'clock. If you are not scheduled to be in this meeting, you might want to leave. But if you are ready to rock and roll with us, we've got a great agenda. I want to recognize the staff for putting together a thoughtful piece of policy work for us to do. Looking forward to all the decisions that we're going to be making this afternoon. I want to recognize my colleagues up here on the DS with me. We've got Commissioner. Introduce yourself.
Commissioner Min.
Commissioner Mendiola.
Commissioner Mendiola and
Commissioner Peralt on behalf of Joe Stephenshaw with the Department of Finance.
All right. Thank you very much. Okay. And Commissioner Mendiola is on behalf of the Lieutenant Governor Eleni Konalakis. We are also going to begin now with an acknowledgement from Mr. Dumlao, or Dr. Dumlao, excuse me.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. We have a quorum present. In addition, I would like to identify members of the staff of the Commission participating for this meeting. Our public speaker announcer today is Nadia Day, and participating virtually is meeting liaison Kim Luneta.
All right, that's great. Thank you very much. For the benefit of those in the audience, the State Lands Commission manages state property interests in over 5 million acres of land, including mineral interests. The commission also has responsibility for the prevention of oil spills at marine oil terminals and offshore oil platforms and islands, and for preventing the introduction of marine invasion species into California's marine waters. Today, we will hear requests and presentations involving the lands and resources within the Commission's jurisdiction. I want to take a moment to acknowledge and express gratitude to the Kumeyaay. Thank you. You can tell I'm an out-of-towner. I'm from the Miwok part of the state. on whose island this meeting is being held. So for millennia, the Kumeyaay have maintained a constant presence on the landscape, living on the coast and fishing in these waters in relationship of balance and reciprocity. I also want to take a moment to honor the California Native American communities all across the state for persisting, for carrying on diverse cultural and linguistic traditions, and for sustainably managing the land that we now share. Native people have maintained a consistent presence on the landscape for many thousands of years, and they are essential steward partners, whether along the coast, along our rivers and valleys, or in our fragile deserts. We thank the California Native American communities for participating in this commission's activities and for their essential role in maintaining and adding to our state's rich cultural legacy. Now, I want to turn it over to Dr. Dumlao to quickly share some instructions on how we can best participate in this meeting so that it runs as smoothly as possible.
Thank you, Chair Cohen. We have two public comment periods, one at the start of the meeting, up to 30 minutes, and one at the end. To speak during either the general public comment period or during an agenda item, please complete the electronic request to speak form on our homepage. We will hear from in-person speakers first, followed by virtual participants in the order requests were received. For virtual participants, please keep your microphone muted until called. To request to speak, raise your hand by clicking on the hand icon in Zoom or by pressing *9 if joining by phone. If calling in and wishing to watch the meeting, please use the CalSpan webcast to avoid audio feedback. If you receive a prompt to be promoted as to panelist, please accept it. When called, you will be unmuted. Remember to unmute your device, identify yourself, and keep comments respectful. Disruptive speakers may be muted or removed. Speakers will be given a maximum of 2 minutes to speak, which may be adjusted to give everyone a chance to speak. For technical issues, contact slc.helpdesk@slc.ca.gov. Written comments may be mailed to cslc.commissionmeetings@slc.ca.gov. And those addresses are also on the webcast right now. Chair Cohen, that concludes the hybrid meeting instructions, and we are ready to move on to the first public comment period.
All right. Our next order of business is the public comment period, one of my favorite points on the agenda. If anyone wants to address the commission on any matter not on today's agenda, staff will call on those who are here in person. Staff will call on those who are here in person today first. Then we will move to those joining us virtually. Nadia, please call the first person who would like to make public comment.
Speaking on behalf of the Port of San Diego will be President and CEO Scott Chadwick, followed by Michael Madrigal.
All right. It's so good to see you, Scott. Thank you for being here.
Let me.
You're good.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
High tech here.
We'll be back.
All right. Well, good afternoon, Madam Chair, Commissioners, Executive Director. My name is Scott Chadwick, and I'm President and CEO for the Port of San Diego. On behalf of the Port, I'd like to extend the warmest of welcomes to the California State Lands Commission. We always look forward to your visits to San Diego and an opportunity to host at our headquarters. I'd like to thank you for your hard work stewarding the public trust lands of this great state. We look to you as a leader and an example of what we can accomplish in our own efforts to protect and enhance port tidelands for the benefit of all Californians. Now, when we last hosted you, my predecessor provided a brief update on our electrification efforts, and I'm happy to share that we've spent or allocated over $227 million on electrification and zero emission projects around the San Diego Bay. Our Maritime Clean Air Strategy, or MCAS, is a catalyst for this investment. To date, we've achieved 80% of our goals. Now, it's because of the remarkable partnership with the Port of San Diego and our State Lands Commission that we've been so successful. With your help, we're making good on our promise to our bayfront communities to drastically reduce harmful emissions that have negatively impacted the public health. At the same time, we're making incredible progress adding or upgrading park space around San Diego Bay. Now, last year, we opened our 23rd park, Sweetwater Park, along the Chula Vista Bayfront. This year, we've celebrated the groundbreaking for improvements we're adding to Harbor Park in Chula Vista, the grand reopening of the newly renovated Pepper Park in National City, which also, I might add, has the first splash pad in the region for us on port tidelands, and as well as the groundbreaking of a new splash pad in Imperial Beach. We at the Port of San Diego and the residents that live near our bayfront, thank you for your continued partnership and investment in the future of our portside communities. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you very much for hosting and welcoming us. We appreciate your remarks. Colleagues, any questions for Scott? None? All right, great. We'll keep moving forward. All right, the next item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the commission's meeting.
We still have.
Oh, there's still public comment? My apologies. My apologies.
Good afternoon, honorable commissioners and present guests and virtual guests. My name is Michael Madrigal. I am a citizen of the Kuya Band of Indians and the current president of the Native American Land Conservancy. First, we'd like to again thank our Kumeyaay Degenya relatives for hosting us here in this place. I would like, secondly, to introduce briefly the work of the Native American Land Conservancy. Our purpose is to strengthen and maintain the ongoing, life-giving, sustaining relationships between California's Native American tribal communities and California's lands. And so, again, we are appreciative that this commission has been charged with the care of a lot of California lands. I would also like to briefly touch on a clear and present danger that is being unfolding in the East Mojave Desert in the form of the Cadiz Water Export Project, and to share with you the work that we have been doing together with nearby tribal nations, the Fort Mojave Indian Tribe and the Chemehuevi Indian Tribe, with them and the National Parks Conservation Association. The Native American Land Conservancy is currently in litigation with the federal government to help protect the waters of the East Mojave Desert. And The waters of the East Mojave are extremely important to all the tribal nations of Southern California desert region. They have sustained our peoples since the beginning of time for countless generations, and they continue to support our cultures and our spiritual practices. And so we want just to first introduce ourselves to you again and let you know about this unfolding danger in the East Mojave Desert. And we look forward to continuing to meet with you all as we work together to protect California's lands and waters. Nessun Achama, my heart is good. I am thankful and I appreciate this opportunity to meet you all.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming down and being a part of this meeting and on the record. Are there any other members of the public that like to speak?
Next speaker will be Lisa Gilfillan, followed by Adam Leverins.
Sure, okay.
I have a couple of slides, if you could call those up, please. And it's great to see you back in this part of the state again. It's been a while. Okay, on the top of this page is a portion of the Newport Beach Granting Statute, more commonly referred to as the Beacon Bay Bill. In the green underlined, I've highlighted the provision that the city may lease the lands or any part thereof for a period not exceeding 50 years for purposes consistent with the public trust. The next part down in the blue text is lands I've seen, or wording I've seen in various state land staff reports, identifying that recreational boating is generally consistent with the common law public trust doctrine, and that the California legislature has identified private recreational boating facilities as an authorized use of public trust land. On the bottom of the page is my mooring permit. After 15 years of planning and dreaming and saving, I finally acquired one in October of 2023, paying $30,000 for a 40-foot mooring permit and a boat, which gives me the right in Newport Beach to lease state lands for storage of that boat. That is less than 3 years ago. Shortly after acquiring that permit, the city decided they wanted to take all the permits for themselves. Again, statute allows me up to 50 years. I've had less than three. On your agenda today, as I have noted at numerous meetings, there's multiple recreational leases for this sort of thing, like Tahoe, Sacramento River, Napa River. Even in Newport Beach, dock holders get 10-year increments up to 50. As far as I can tell, I'm the only permit holder who doesn't get equality with other users, and that's all we're asking for. Next slide, please. The city back in 2022 had an agenda item of a mooring buyback where they'd spend $1 million a year for 30 years to acquire the permits. About 18 months later, they decided they would steal the permits. State land staff report regarding Newport Beach suggests that they review their alternative recommendation for moorings. I also suggest that state lands have the city review its mooring buyback program. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there another speaker that would like to speak in public comment?
Next comment via Zoom will be Captain Patricia Cummins, followed by Bud Cummins.
Patricia Cummins.
Hi. Thank you for hearing us out. I appreciate your time. My name is Patricia Cummins. I'm a retired captain. I live aboard here in Newport Beach, and big changes that are quite scary happening here for us. Just wanted to bring this to the attention. In 2025, state lands released at least three variations of what became the report on the city of Newport Beach public lands management. Two versions, staff report 66 from the August meeting and report 105 from the December meeting, containing language, I'll quote here, there are clear differences in rate variations for moorings and residential piers. The trend for moorings permit rates have been to use regular appraisals to reflect market conditions. The trend for residential pier permits has been to reduce the overall rent amount through reductions of lease area and lowering of rates without conducting new or updated appraisals. These decisions appear to be political in nature and may violate both the granting statute and the California Constitution, end of quote. After release of the August version, a Newport Beach Harbor Commission wrote, also making note of political sensitivities and realities with these matters. Within the agenda materials for 2025 meeting, it is redlined version of the staff report of 105. In it, state lands redlines text from pages 4 and 5. The language that decisions, and quote, appear to be political in nature, unquote, from the earlier report from 66 is included within the report of 105 on the same pages 4 and 5 and is not redlined. However, the report on the City of Newport Beach Public Lands Trust Management sent to the city this past January does not contain, quote, appears to be political in nature, unquote. It just seems to be a lot of things changing that should be in the report. Thank you for your time. But my husband is here. He signed up as a speaker. Should he go next?
Yes, please.
Hi, good afternoon. My name is Bud Coombs. That was my wife. And I'm going to more or less continue. At your December of 2025 meeting, remarks were made that you wanted the City of Newport Beach to show sufficient progress in 3 to 6 months, addressing issues state land staff had identified. On February 10th, 2026, after having received state land's final report, Newport's mayor and council voted to form an ad hoc committee of only 2 members of themselves to later advise all the members of themselves. This action was taken with Resolution 2026-16, some images of which are in the letter we sent you for today's meeting. The resolution states the ad hoc, quote, the sole purpose and responsibility of the committee is to review and develop recommendations to the full City Council regarding a legally compliant, transparent, and strategic path forward to ensure that the city's actions are consistent with applicable state law and public trust principles. That's the end of the quote. 4 council seats in Newport are up for grabs this November, which many may explain why, after formation of the ad hoc committee, the city seems to have rethought and shifted these duties back to the Harbor Commission, a commission not elected by nor accountable to the public and who created and oversaw years of the city's problematic management of public trust lands, as well as being the originator of many of the issues we all have to deal with now. State lands should seriously consider that the city's ever-changing whims on who's going to deal with the issues locally and on what time frame, along with the in-process now, stretched out appraisal shopping, do not constitute sufficient progress. They constitute stalling beyond an election cycle and perpetuating clear instances of discrepancy in rates, rights, and coastal access for another year or more. Thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Holly or George? Halakima?
It appears you are muted. If you can please unmute yourself and begin your comment.
Is it Chaley or George first?
Doesn't matter.
Chaley or George?
Doesn't matter.
Okay. Hi, my name is Chaley Hilkema, and I'm a Newport Harbor mooring permit holder. The City of Newport Beach has unfairly mismanaged the tidelands for decades. Mooring permit holders don't enjoy the luxury of the financial favoritism the city gifts to yacht clubs and owners of multi-million-dollar harborfront homes. Comparatively, we're overcharged, highly regulated, and strictly monitored. Mooring-related policy processes aren't transparent, policies are changed erratically, and consequential decisions are made without adequate stakeholder input. The city's bias is blatant. Its partiality became even more obvious when it threatened to raise only our fees 300 to 500% and end only our permit transferability and take our mooring permits without compensating us. Many in our user group appealed to this commission with hopes that it would recognize and right these injustices, but to date, it, quote, appears that your staff report 105 has further emboldened the city. It says that State Lands is requiring it to end the mooring transfer program because it violates the California Constitution, though there are words like may and appears to that precede the word violate that suggest only possibilities. The city has conveniently chosen a preferred understanding of what the staff report 105 actually says, and it spread its mindset in city documents. It wants reasonable people to believe that its intention is to protect the public interest. But if that were true, why would the city allow residential pier permit transfers to continue when they generate $1 million and more of private value and when homes are sold? And why would it continue to allow those with residential piers permits to rent dock space for private financial gain, which can amount to many thousands of dollars of profit per year? It seems highly unlikely to me that the city is truly concerned about the private monetization of the public tidelands. But what its policies do show is that it has a preference for who benefits. If the city changes long-established policy by arbitrarily ending only mooring permit transferability, its actions would not only be indefensible, it would be discriminatory. Thank you for your efforts to help us. Go ahead, Ben.
Next up will be George Halkema.
My name is George Halkema. I've had my vote on a mooring in Newport Harbor for 40 years. This commission has made me aware, has been made aware that the city of Newport Beach has threatened to end mooring permit transfers again. Our user group has been singled out from the city's preferred permit holders whose boating opportunities have not been jeopardized. I've served on committees to address the city's mooring related issues like mooring boundary line derrick boats and mooring transfer processes. In 2010, the city manager totally disregarded one committee's good work, and permit fees were raised and permit transfers were ended. After much outcry, new council members reevaluated mooring fees and transferability. I served on yet another subcommittee, and finally in 2017, fees were lowered and transferability was restored. But here we are again having to fight the same fight to save our access to Newport Harbor. It's important to be aware that early Newport Harbor boaters were encouraged by federal, state, and city policymakers to create moorings, which was done at their expense and risk. Their efforts and investment brought opportunities for recreational boaters and greatly enhanced Newport Harbor, which is today touted as a world-renowned small craft harbor. For nearly 100 years, moorings in Newport Harbor have been transferred between boaters on an open market with city approval. As Newport Beach became more desired destination, the system that emerged especially benefited boat-owning members of the public who couldn't afford to buy homes and with private piers, but who had an opportunity to purchase a permit in a preferred location. I was a member of the public who wanted to be a recreational boater, but first I needed a place to store a boat. I've adhered to the city regulation for 40 years.
You've got two sentences.
If the city ends mooring permit transfers, it will ruin my ability to recoup some of the substantial amount of money I paid for what I assured was a transferable permit. Such action will be a financial burden in my retirement. Thank you.
Thank you for the little extra time to come here, Smith.
All right, thank you.
Next is Dave Hahn, followed by Jennifer Creston.
Hello, my name's Dave Hahn. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Yes, great. Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to speak here. I've been a mooring holder for 10 years, and with the intentions when I purchased this was to be here and retire here in Newport Beach. I love the place. And with the city taking on the action of removing my transferability, that's going to take a substantial financial hit. And everybody that has a mooring out here is going to have the same impact on them, which to me seems criminal. I don't know how they could do this. You, like Adam was saying, you go in here with a 50-year opportunity, and I've only had 10, so I think I should still have 40 left on this. And then the unfair treatment and pricing between the dock owners and the mooring holders is it's crazy. The discrepancy in prices, they're paying less than half or twice the space. I mean, I don't understand why the Attorney General isn't all over this and looking in deeply into this whole thing. It's very, very troubling to me, and I hope that we can come to some other kind of a reasonable solution. The benchmark was mentioned more than once that would be bring the prices down for everybody and make them affordable and a long-term deal. They're using the benchmark all over California. I don't understand why Newport Beach is so so different in that aspect. And that's pretty much what I have to say. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there a public comment? Another public comment?
Next is Jennifer Creston, followed by Graham Marisol Martin Sitaro.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Oh, great. I'm Jennifer, and I'm here today to speak in relation to an 11-page letter sent to the commission on June 17th, July 23rd, and August 20th. Coastal access is being put at risk for thousands of people. We urge the commission to look again at the broader picture of granted lands management in Newport Harbor. Please help us ensure that access for everyday working families is not overshadowed by wealth, political influence, or special interests. There's been a long series of events in Newport Beach illustrating a pattern of inequitable treatment toward those with fewer financial resources. For perspective on this, many of the waterfront homes in Newport Harbor with private transferable docks attached are currently listed on Zillow between approximately $8.75 million and $59 million. Not everyone has access to that level of financial, social, or political capital. Yet many families, teachers, first responders, retirees, and working Californians have been able to maintain stable and affordable access to Newport Harbor and the ocean through leases of submerged lands for recreational moorings, just as is done in places throughout California. Mooring programs like ours thrive when stakeholders have skin in the game. The ability for permittees to self-maintain their moorings and transfer them to other members of the public, much like individuals with greater means are permitted to do with their docks and as other leaseholders on public trust lands are also allowed to do, helps keep costs low, encourages responsible stewardship, and preserves affordable access for the less affluent. When these incentives are removed, costs typically increase and access becomes less attainable for ordinary people. We hope the Commission considers these facts as important context. The decisions being made now are not simply about harbor administration. They will help determine whether Newport Harbor remains accessible to a broad cross-section of the public or becomes increasingly reserved for those with the greatest of means. Thank you very much.
Next is Graham Marisol Martin Sitaro, followed by Steve Worthington.
Graham, it appears you are on mute. If you can unmute yourself to begin your comment.
Can you hear me now? Good afternoon. Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair and members of the Commission. I'm here today to ask the Commission to reconsider its April 7th consent calendar approval of Item 43, which eliminates the Santa Barbara seasonal anchorage without a public hearing or environmental review. Area C is a free open public seasonal anchorage with our over a century of continuous public use. In 2005, the Coastal Commission staff report called it the most convenient place for visitors to anchor due to its proximity to harbor facilities and an important recreational resource for visiting boaters. The Commission's 2006 lease designated Area A and C as free public anchoring with legal consideration defined as public use and benefit. That lease authorized mooring only in Area B. Area C was never a mooring field. This commission eliminated a century-old public resource through a consent calendar, a process designed for non-controversial items. The conversion of a public trust resource to commercial use is inherently controversial. More critically, the CEQA determination was not finalized at the time of the vote. The notice of the exemption was signed 6 days after the vote. The commissioners never reviewed the CEQA determination. CEQA guidelines section 15061 requires the agency to determine whether the project is exempt as part of its preliminary review before approval. The vote preceded the determination. This commission has an affirmative duty to take the public trust into account and protect public trust uses whenever feasible. The staff report claims the amendment will not substantially impact public trust consistent use. The commission made no findings comparing public trust uses before and after. Before, it was an open free visitors access for 45 boats, after 17 permitted spaces with fees and controlled access. Publicly owned is not the same as publicly available. The 1925 legislative grant for these tidelands contains an anti-alienation provision. The CEQA history for the program is contradictory. In 2006, the SLC conducted a full environmental review. In 2021, the SLC exempted it as a Class 1 existing facility, claiming no change to existing activities and no unusual circumstance. In 2026, the SLC reclassified it as a Class 3 new construction. I'll let Steve continue. Thank you for your time.
Next speaker will be Steve Worthington, followed by in-person comment, Lena Ortega.
Stephen Worthington? Okay.
Is that on? Yes?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry. So the notice of exemption signed by SLC staff is actually false. It contains four claims contradicted by the commission's own record. First, it claims minor physical change. The staff report describes 17 new mooring buoys with heavy chains and clump weights on the seafloor. That is not minor. Second, it claims no change in existing activities. This is actually the most important thing. The existing activity is the 190-year-old free seasonal anchorage. The project converts this area to a fee-based commercial mooring. Third, it asserts no unusual circumstances with no analysis. It makes no mention of desal infrastructure and destruction of the benthic environment or the Coastal Commission's permit surveys requiring biological eelgrass. Getting to the public trust, this commission has an affirmative duty to take public trust into account and protect public trust uses wherever feasible. The staff report claims that the amendment will not substantially impact public trust consistent uses. The commission made no findings comparing public trust uses before and after. Before is a free visitor access that exists at present for 45 boats. I've seen as many as 80. After 17 permitted spaces, should this actually happen, is controlled by the harbor, requires people to go in and sign up, and publicly owned. Yes, of course, taxpayers own facilities, but this isn't publicly available. This will turn this into a no man's land, like North versus South Korea. The 1925 legislative grant for these tidelands contains an anti-alienation. Thank you.
Next comment will be Lena Ortega.
We have no hands raised for comment at this time.
All right. Thank you very much for moderating us through that public comment. And thank you to the members of the public that commented. Next item of business will be the adoption of the minutes from the commission's meeting of June 23rd and July 28th, 2026. May I have a motion to approve the minutes and a second?
So moved.
All right.
Second.
All right, a motion has been made and a motion has been seconded. Can we take this with without objections?
Yes.
Without it, unanimous? All right. That motion passes unanimously. Thank you. next item would be the executive. The next order of business is the executive officer's report. Dr. Dumlao, may we have that report now?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
First, I want to thank the Port of San Diego for hosting us here. It is an incredible venue, and every time I come to San Diego, I want to convert my round trip flight to a one way. It's absolutely gorgeous. Unfortunately, I do have a topic I wanted to share that is not quite as pleasant as the rest of San Diego. And since we are in San Diego, I wanted to share some updates with this commission on the Tijuana River pollution crisis. So in October 2024, which was the last time the commission held a meeting in the San Diego region, we presented you, the commissioners, with troubling information about the Tijuana River. We told you about the billions of gallons of contaminated water and raw sewage that were flowing across the border into San Diego County each year. We told you about the reports of human health impacts, including gastrointestinal and respiratory illnesses due to poor air and water quality. We described how polluted flows were adversely affecting water and air quality in the region, stressing coastal habitats and organisms, and prompting beach closures along the San Diego coast. Since that time, progress has been made to address this crisis, and it's outlined in more detail in my executive officer's report, but just a few examples here to highlight. As of August 2025, modifications to the South Bay International Wastewater Treatment Plant have resulted in 10 million gallons per day of additional wastewater treatment capacity at the plant, bringing the interim capacity up to 35 million gallons per day. And the U.S. section of the International Boundary and Water Commission has committed to expand capacity to 50 million gallons per day. The state of California has also implemented several projects that have removed thousands of tons of trash in the river and have begun to restore habitat along contaminated property adjacent to the Tijuana River. And furthermore, in California's enacted state budget for fiscal year 26-27 includes funding for a border water quality protection unit at the San Diego Water Board to address cross-border pollution. Despite the progress, we know this crisis is still far from over. It will take years to build the infrastructure, to expand treatment capacity, and to build in some durable, long-lasting solutions. The transboundary pollution continues to be a threat to human health and safety and directly interferes with the ability of the public to access and enjoy coastal environments. I think everyone who has gone down to the ocean and saw those signs saying raw sewage, do not go in the water, it's heartbreaking to not be able to go into the ocean. Commission staff remain committed and engaged in identifying opportunities to support federal, state, and local efforts that address the transboundary pollution crisis. And I'm really pleased to share, to introduce actually someone from the region who has been instrumental in all of the work to address the transboundary pollution, and that is Mr. Dave Gibson, the Executive Director for the San Diego Regional Water Quality Control Board, who is here right behind me. And there are, a million things going on, and we have tons of heroes who are working hard to address the pollution crisis, and Mr. Gibson is certainly one of the most important and most just dogged individuals trying to tackle this water pollution crisis. And so we wanted to give him a couple minutes just to share his perspective from the Regional Water Quality Control Board, and to share some thoughts on how things are progressing with some of these large infrastructure improvement projects that we have on tap. So, Mr. Gibson, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Dumlao. Thank you, Dr. Dumlao. Thank you very much,
Chair Cohen and members of the commission. I thought I was going to spend about an hour or so talking with you today. I could easily do that. But I will summarize a few brief points and be very happy to take any questions you have regarding the report you have today in my comments. First of all, I want to thank you for your partnership and your leadership over these last some years. You joined us with our litigation against IBWC in 2018. You joined us in our defense of their litigation in 2021. Those actions brought us in part where we are today, and we have some progress. Unfortunately, we also have to acknowledge that the beaches in Imperial Beach have been closed for 1,718 days, nearly consecutively. We had one magical 48-hour period last year in October, when all the flows and stars aligned and the beaches opened for 48 hours. But unfortunately, 11 out of the last 16 years, those beaches have been closed because of discharges of wastewater in Mexico, as well as discharges in wastewater in Mexico conveyed down the Tijuana River itself. We have seen progress, however, in the portfolio of projects being advanced by the two countries under the Binational Statement of Intent in Minutes 328 and Minute 333. Right now, PBCLA, the River Diversion System in Mexico, which was built in 1990 pursuant to Minute 283, has been upgraded in 2021 to 35 million gallons per day, and they have now been able to operate it at 35 million gallons per day most of this year. They have reduced the flows in the river from over 50 million gallons per day last year to about 4 to 5 million gallons per day this year. PBCLA is that key component. But PBCLA, all the collectors in Tijuana, they all flow into one location, and that's Pump Station 1, immediately south of the International Wastewater Treatment Plant. It's the bottleneck in that hourglass. And that pump station is very old. The pumps are out of date. They've been damaged previously. They are currently underway and being repaired, but the predictability of PBCLA operation is really contingent upon the predictability of that pump station operating. Those flows, 35 million gallons per day, that are currently being captured and diverted to the coast are not treated. They're discharged on the shoreline at Punta Bandera untreated, and they are a major reason why the beaches have been closed for 11 out of the last 16 years. And that situation won't change until augmented treatment is available for those flows. San Antonio de los Buenos was constructed by Mexico pursuant to Minute 328. Outstanding. It's 18 million gallons per day. It appears to be working very well. That's 18 million gallons per day less wastewater discharged on the coast untreated. We expect to see improvements in the operation of PBCLA Pump Station 1 that will help improve beach closures as well. The even better news is that with the reduced flows down to about 3 to 5 million gallons per day, the 7-day average for the last 7 days is 4.26 million gallons per day, air quality has improved. It's not perfect. One still feels and suffers the issues with hydrogen sulfide, but we haven't had a major exceedance of the 30 parts per billion threshold since June 27th. It is a function of flow. Our goal at the regional board is working with Mexico, working with the IBWC and US EPA, is end the daily flows. Mm. Ending the daily flows will end the hydrogen sulfide issues in the main. That's the key public health issue right now. One can avoid going to the beach. One cannot live in one's house right now under the conditions that they're experiencing there. There are two key projects moving forward pursuant to Minute 333 that will, I think, yield results and push us past the tipping point. One is the River Gates project, long delayed, that would remove about 3 to 5 million gallons per day. Remember, I said we have about 3 to 5 million gallons per day right now left to deal with after PBCLA. The completion of that project to capture flows of wastewater that are currently being released via storm drains to the Tijuana Channel could put us to the point of having zero flows in the U.S. on a dry day. And then two, even more important for two reasons, are the redirection of wastewater from La Marita and Arturo Herrera wastewater plants, about 12 to 15 million gallons per day of treated wastewater. It doesn't stay clean very long once it reaches the river. Diverting those flows to upstream of Rodriguez Reservoir, again, brings the level of the river down to the point where PBCLA is more than capable of handling the diversions and reduces, in fact, the amount going to the coast. That's also important for a second reason. Tijuana is at the end of the Colorado River, as are we, and they are even more vulnerable. So this would provide additional water available to them for indirect potable reuse to help improve water supply resilience in Tijuana. Moving forward, the regional board is working with IBWC. I will meet with the commissioner tomorrow morning. We have amended our permit for IBWC to cover the 35 million gallons per day in the current blending configuration. We plan to issue a new permit next year, and we will update that permit for the full 50 million gallon per day expansion expected to be completed in 2030. That will be, and I will reiterate this 10 times, a full secondary treatment plant at 50 million gallons per day. The board has communicated that although it may take longer, it is the necessary component to the entire strategy of source control in Mexico, conveyance improvement in Mexico, and augmented treatment in Mexico and the U.S. There is so much more that I could cover, but I'll be happy at this point to take your questions. And I hope that by this time next year, we can report that we reached the tipping point, that the flows of the Tijuana River are now just stormwater flows. Those were always problematic in terms of quality. And we will have improvement now of treatment on the coast. Mexico is studying expansion of San Antonio de los Buenos. If they ultimately fund that, I want to point out that those river diversion flows could go to that plant and be treated. And that would be the 95% solution to beach closures in Imperial Beach and the 75% solution the EPA studied for river flows in the Tijuana River. There's so much more that I could cover, but I would be happy at this point to take your questions.
I do have a question.
Please.
I just wanted to know if you could update us on how the conversations are going between the U.S. and Mexico authorities.
U.S. EPA and IBWC handle most of those conversations. Where we are asked to participate, they have been productive. Both countries are committed to the success of Minute 328 and Minute 333. It has been challenging at times to understand the lack of progress on some of the key projects like the river gates, but we're really approaching the point now where we have a deadline for the completion as well as for the redirection of Arturo Herrera and La Marita. That was not clear for some time. Mm-hmm. So I think we're getting there in terms of better communication. The regional board does have two requirements in our permits. One of them is for a regional technical group to meet binationally twice a year. The board has reemphasized the importance of this in its amendment, and the board has also asked, though we cannot require, that the Citizens Forum be reinstituted. I understand that EPA is convening a forum along those lines to improve communication in the U.S. and Mexico jointly at these forums. So the communications are always a challenge in our asymmetrical relationship between our countries, but that is a key component of our success, and so far we're making progress.
Thank you. I appreciate that. How do you feel about the progress?
I'm watching this
like a hawk. You know this more than anyone else. You gave me the public line.
Yes.
Now you tell me, what does your heart say? What are you seeing and experiencing?
Yes, Madam Chair. I think we're very close to that tipping point I referred to. I check the beach closures twice a day. The mm-hmm. county updates them at least once. I check the air quality readings at least once a day. I'm monitoring the Scripps Institution of Oceanography's real-time pathogen prediction model, which shows the flows from the Tijuana River and in San Antonio and how they affect the coast. And I see the reduction in flows with the operation of PBCLA. The key is making sure that those infrastructure improvements are durable and that we are operating them credibly. That requires a level of negotiation between the United States and Mexico that I'm not aware of anywhere else in California, and it requires a level of diligence by my staff to the point where this one plant and this one discharge requires more than all of the other POTWs in our region combined. That's why we've requested that augmentation of staff, and I think we're getting there. So I am optimistic, but I have been disappointed before, and I'm watching this carefully like a hawk, and the board is utilizing every enforcement tool and all the influence we have to ensure that the progress continues on the treatment plant expansion, consideration of expansion of San Antonio, and the completion and the timely communication of the projects in Minute 328, Minute 333. There is a website. It's hard to tell sometimes what the real status of those projects are. So we routinely request that information and pass that on to Cal EPA to make sure that they're informed.
So talk to me a little bit about how the health of the neighbors that are around the surrounding area, close to the beach, how are they doing?
It has been bad, I will say that. I'm not a doctor. I'm not an epidemiologist. The regional board.
What are you?
I'm actually an entomologist by training,
okay.
And I'm a biologist.
Okay.
I'm a biologist, and I pretend to sometimes understand some things about law and hydrology and quite a few other things.
Fair enough. But you're not a medical doctor. But tell me.
But I do attend meetings regularly with the County of San Diego, where they do have the public health. The exposure to hydrogen sulfide is problematic. Mm-hmm. It is one thing to be exposed to it in the workplace where you can have controls and measures, but it's different to be exposed to it in your home 24 hours a day. Our board vice chair, Dr. Betty Olson, not a doctor, has been very concerned about the chronic health effects on school-aged children. One of the stations is Berry Elementary School, less than 3,000 feet from the Tijuana River. It is where we see the highest degree in numbers of exceedances, but that's also where all the kids live. And they're exposed to that 24 hours a day. So the introduction of air filters is, I think, helped mitigate some of the exposure, but it doesn't change the fact that going outside, opening your windows, being exposed to it 24 hours a day, even though the numbers have come down a lot, they're still being exposed to some. It's at the range of now 1 to 4 parts per billion instead of 30 plus or 700 parts per billion. So that exposure, that chronic exposure, until a real competent epidemiology study is conducted, I don't know that I know exactly what that is, but we're very concerned that it end, and it end with the flows. That's the ultimate solution here. I want to point out, too, that when IBWC was built, the treatment plant, in 1999, Tijuana River flows had been 365 days a year for 2 decades up to that point, and they ended. And from between 2000 and 2017, we did not have daily flows, nor did we have the air quality issues that we have now. It was really with the resumption of daily flows in excess of times 80 million gallons per day in 2021 that we had the return of this health issue and the exposure both in air quality and beach water quality exposures. Ending those flows ends those risks. But looking backwards at the issues in terms of health, I have advised my own wife that we're not going down to Imperial Beach for the beach recreation. But I absolutely, along with our board, want relief, permanent relief, for the residents who live there. It's very different to visit a plant. It's very different to live in it, and that's not acceptable.
How are seniors doing?
Seniors and children are among the most vulnerable in terms of the health effects of hydrogen sulfide, which include nausea, eye irritation, sinus irritation, discomfort. Many people have reported in the several studies that they have literally left the neighborhood at night because they couldn't afford to be there any longer. And, of course, their conditions improved as soon as they left. Mm-hmm. That's not an acceptable outcome. The flows have to be ceased, and that requires engagement by the U.S. and Mexico at the highest levels, and it requires follow-through so that these improvements are not temporary, that they become permanent.
So from your perspective, what could this body be doing more of or better?
I think your support already in our litigation that I mentioned a few moments ago and continuing to have these discussions and dialogue. Going forward, I have permitting authority and enforcement authority. What I emphasized to the legislature in requesting the BCP was that not only do we need to write permits, but we need to be able to litigate again if necessary. That enforcement threshold is I think, an important deterrence to make sure that the federal governments in both countries understand that we're serious and that this problem has to be managed now effectively, as it once was.
Thank you for taking my questions. Colleagues, you have a question? Of course.
Yeah, I just had a question regarding Proposition 4. So yes. California opened $46 million in Prop 4 grants in June for the cross-border water pollution projects on top of the roughly $38 million already committed since 2019. How will the state ensure these funds are directed towards the highest impact projects, since you mentioned some of the issues that are impacting the communities, and how will they be coordinated with much larger federal investments to avoid duplication of those gaps?
Very good question. Thank you, Commissioner. First of all, the State Water Resources Control Board approved guidelines that determines eligibility and priorities. They do need to address issues both in the New River and the Tijuana River. We have emphasized projects in our recommendations to them that are focused on long-term, credible, and durable gains and that are not a displacement of federal funding or an augmentation of federal funding in a non-constructive way. Local agencies like the State Parks and City of San Diego, County of San Diego, and City of Imperial Beach have invested an extraordinary amount of money addressing the symptoms, the excess of sedimentation, the flooding, the closure of a campground, the amount of trash that was mentioned earlier. It costs about $40 per tire to remove tires from the Tijuana River once it gets down into the forested canopy. Capturing them in a trash boom is far more effective. Source control in Mexico would be far preferable, but we realized with our Tijuana River Valley Recovery Strategy in 2012 that we needed to address the conveyance of these pollutants where they exist in the U.S., in the Tijuana River, Smugglers Gulch and Goat Canyon. So our priorities that we identified for State Board are based on the recovery strategy. We've invested many years in the science of hydrology, and we know what the waste loads are, and we know what the costs are. My longer-term concern is for operations and maintenance. State Parks has invested over $20 million in maintaining their two sediment basins and the trash boom in Goat Canyon. But for that investment, they would have lost the estuary many years ago to sedimentation and trash. So those investments are important. So the State Board has considered our priorities, our strategy, as well as the New River strategy, and they will be looking for projects that are force multipliers on the binational investments in source control and conveyance control that I mentioned earlier. There are non-governmental organizations that I hope will also compete for the funds, like Wild Coast. They've installed two trash booms in Mexico, and they've established the trash collection centers in Mexico. We take for granted that a trash truck comes by once a week. That is not the case everywhere in Tijuana. So giving people a place to come and take their trash to be properly disposed of is a proactive measure that I'm really glad that the philanthropists have gotten behind to support. That is a big-winded answer to your question, but we'll be advising the State Board as we have before. The Board's adopted two advanced restoration plans, one for trash, one for bacterial indicators, surrogate for sewage, and we've emphasized that those loads should be attained with the Prop 4 projects. And I think that there are about 16 projects that we identified for about $46 million total cost that should accomplish those load reductions and sustain them going forward. Long-term operations and maintenance, however, continues to be an issue.
Thank you.
I think that exhausts our questions up here. Thank you very much for being so diligent, so committed, and then bringing it back to us. This is a priority.
Thank you, Chair.
My pleasure. Thank you. Okay.
And I just had a couple final things to say in my executive officer report. First, thank you, Dave, for that great presentation. In my last remarks here, I just wanted to highlight a few personnel updates. I want to welcome Nicole Fisher as our new office technician in the Marine Environmental Protection Division. Also, our Administrative Services Division, welcome back Jasenia Castellon as an accountant technician, and Holly Pollack as an analyst too. The Mineral Resources Management Division welcomed Eric Osorio as an associate process safety engineer. And I also want to congratulate Jim Kepke, our supervising boundary determination officer with the Land Management Division, on completing 25 years of state service. And also, Environmental Science Planning and Management Division promoted Robin Tui to a senior environmental scientist role, and the Marine Environmental Protection Division promoted Everard A. Da Silva as a Marine Safety Specialist 1. So congratulations to them for well-deserved promotions. And lastly, I want to recognize Kristen Schwartz, who retired from our Information Services Division after 35 years of service to the state. And we wish Kristen the best in her next chapter. And that concludes my executive officer report.
Thank you very much. Colleague, do we have any questions for the executive director? No? Thank you, Dr. Dumlau. We appreciate that. I think we're going to go on to the next item on our calendar. That's the consent calendar. The next order of business will be the adoption of the consent calendar items 1 through 50. Commissioners, are there any items that you would like to remove from the consent calendar? None? Seeing none? Okay. Next, I'd like to call on Dr. Dumlau to indicate which items, if any, have been removed from the consent calendar.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Consent item 14 has been removed from the agenda per the applicant's request.
Okay.
And will be considered at a later time. And then consent item 43 is moved from the consent agenda to the regular agenda.
All right, thank you. Thank you very much. May I have a motion to adopt the consent agenda? May I have a second as well?
So moved.
All right.
Second.
All right, great. The motion has been made and it's been seconded. Without any objections, I believe we could take this without unanimously. All right. That vote passes unanimously. Next item is going to be the regular calendar. The next order of business will be, we'll hear from Dr. Dumlau.
All right, so the next item is item 51, and it's a presentation by staff to consider authorizing the executive officer to enter into a co-management agreement with tribal, state, and local governments to restore the Clear Lake watershed. Jessica Ramirez will give the staff presentation.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Nice to see you all. Good afternoon, Madam Chair, Commissioners. As Dr. Dumloud mentioned, I am Jessica Ramirez, and I serve as the Environmental Justice and Tribal Liaison for the Commission. And I will be giving the staff presentation for Item 51 for the Commission's consideration of authorizing the executive officer or designee to enter into a memorandum of understanding for a co-management agreement with tribal, state, and local governments to restore Clear Lake, its watershed and basin, through shared stewardship and the recovery of the Clear Lake Hitch. Next slide, please. Clear Lake and its watershed and basin are within the ancestral homelands of the Pomo and the Lake Miwok people. For tribal communities, this landscape is much more than a collection of natural resources. Its plants, wildlife, waters, cultural resources, and fisheries are deeply connected to tribal identity, cultural practices, community, and the economy. Next slide, please. The Clear Lake Hitch, known as Chai in Pomo and Sati in Lake Miwok, is one important example of the need for this agreement. The hitch is a native fish found only within the Clear Lake watershed. Its populations have declined considerably due to multiple overlapping stressors, including drought, altered hydrology, water quality, invasive species, contaminants, and other cumulative environmental pressures. Next slide. The proposed agreement does not begin from scratch. In 2017, Assembly Bill 707 established the Blue Lake Ribbon, the Blue Ribbon Committee for the rehabilitation of Clear Lake. The 15-member committee brought together tribal representatives, Lake County, state, and academic partners, as well as community organizations to study rehabilitation needs and recommend projects that could benefit the lake's economy, ecosystem, and cultural heritage. Beginning in 2022, federally recognized tribes and the California Department of Fish and Wildlife established the Clear Lake Hitch Task Force. The task force created a forum for tribal governments and government agencies to coordinate emergency response and longer-term work involving the hitch recovery, conservation, monitoring, research, habitat restoration, and water management. Other state and local agencies subsequently joined these efforts. The proposed agreement builds on that foundation and provides a broader, more durable structure for continued collaboration. Next slide, please. Here you'll see a list of the participating tribal governments, which include the Big Valley Band of Pomo Indians, the Koi Nation, the Middletown Rancheria of Pomo Indians, and the Robinson Rancheria. Next slide, please. And here you'll see the list of the participating local and state governments. For local governments, it includes the County of Lake, the City of Clear Lake. And for the participating state agencies, it includes the Natural Resources Agency and several of its departments, which include the State Lands Commission, as well as the California Environmental Protection Agency and several of its departments. Next slide. The agreement establishes an overarching framework for collaboration among seven federally recognized tribes and 12 state and four local governments. Importantly, it preserves the existing legal authorities, responsibilities, funding requirements, and governmental sovereignty of each participating government. It also expressly recognizes that this agreement is not the final form of co-management. Instead, it is intended to strengthen coordination, power sharing, and working relationships, and to create a framework that can support future collaboration efforts. The Commission's participation would be limited and consistent with its statutory authorities. The Commission does not have direct regulatory or resource management role in the recovery of the hitch. The primary interest under this agreement is related to the Commission's oversight authority and review responsibilities for lands that have legislatively been granted to Lake County. The agreement does not give the Commission new jurisdiction over Clear Lake, its tributaries, or other lands or resources. Next slide. The agreement organizes the collaboration into 8 broad areas listed here. They include identifying and addressing historical wrongs and supporting present-day healing, hitch recovery and habitat restoration, native species recovery and control of invasive species, research, monitoring, and sharing of knowledge and data, communication, public engagement, and education, as well as workforce development training. Together, these areas recognize that restoration of Clear Lake requires more than a single project or an agency response. It requires coordinated attention to ecological, cultural, governmental, and community needs. Next slide, please. Staff recommends the Commission authorize the executive officer or designee to enter into the Memorandum of Understanding co-management agreement for stewardship and co-management of the Clear Lake watershed and the Clear Lake Hitch. This agreement provides an opportunity to support collaborative stewardship while respecting the sovereignty and existing legal authorities of all participating governments. The proposed action also strengthens the Commission's longstanding commitment to maintaining government-to-government relationships with California Native American tribes. It also advances several priorities identified in the Commission's strategic plan, including meeting evolving public trust needs, partnering with sovereign tribal governments, prioritizing social, economic, and environmental justice, and committing to collaborative leadership. Next slide, please. That concludes staff's presentation. We are available to answer any questions.
Great, thank you. I think we have one over here. Michelle?
Not so much a question, but I appreciate the presentation, and I continue to appreciate where all of our boards and commissions that work in the natural resources area are finding ways to really come together, not just at the state level, but regionally and specifically with our tribes to work towards these kinds of collaborative projects. I will say that Clear Lake is near and dear to my heart. It is the lake that was closest to where I grew up at, and it is anything but clear. So I'm glad to see that there is some collaborative effort going forward to sort of figure out the best way to do some restoration and make sure that we're doing it in a way that respects and honors, not just where Clear Lake is, but the people that live on the land there. So again, just appreciate this opportunity, and I think it's a wonderful thing to do to create an MOU. So when it's time, I'd love to move the item.
All right, that's great. Thank you, Jessica. I appreciate the presentation as well. In my briefing, I've shared with members of the staff that I too grew up going to Clear Lake from San Francisco. I don't think it ever was clear, at least not in my lifetime. But it has sadly gotten worse in our lifetime. And so here we are in a position to correct some wrongs that have happened in the past, and I'm really excited. I wish we could speed this up a little bit further along, quite honestly, and we could make this an aggressive timeline so that our kids would be able to reap the benefits of going to Clear Lake, as well as seeing a thriving economy around the lake and the cities or the towns that surround and make up Lake County. So I'm really excited. I'm very enthusiastic about this initiative. And I applaud everyone that is working on this project and encourage everyone to go faster.
Thank you, commissioners. I do want to say that one of the things that I learned in this process is that Clear Lake is one of California's oldest natural freshwater lakes, so it is really a special place.
That is good to hear. Thank you for the presentation. I don't think we have any other questions for you. Dr. Jamlau, any words from you?
Nope, okay. Just public comment, I think.
All right, we'll take public comment on that. Nadia, do we have any public comment on item 51?
There's no public comment.
Okay, thank you. Commissioners, do you guys have any more comments or questions? All right, seeing none, may I have a motion to adopt the staff's recommendation as well as a second?
So moved.
Second.
All right, thank you. Looks like we're on a roll. That's you. That's a unanimous second, and a motion made and second, and we'll take that unanimously without objection. It passes. If there are, let's keep going to item 52. It's a presentation by staff of the recent
peer-review scientific publication by the Marine Invasive Species Program. May we have that staff presentation? Good to see you. Thank you so much. The floor is yours when you're ready.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. My name is Chris Schiani, and I'm the Environmental Program Manager for our multi-agency Marine Invasive Species Program. I'm here to present item 52, an informational item highlighting two collaborative peer-reviewed scientific journal articles that we recently published. So next slide, please. The Marine Invasive Species Program was created in 1999 and has been in effect since 2000. We are an invasive species prevention program focused on pathway management with the commercial shipping industry as the pathway that we manage and regulate. As a regulatory program, we have to rely on the best available science to develop, implement, and enforce our rules. Next slide, please. Our program has always been on the cutting edge of invasive species management and biological invasion science, and we are globally recognized as such. And because of this fact, our data often becomes the best available science in this field. So it has been important to us to publish our work often through the peer-reviewed journal process, often in collaboration with international colleagues that we work with on these issues. Publishing these important data also allows us to rely on our own scientifically vetted research to inform our regulation development and allows our partners in other states and countries to use our science as the best available when they are developing and implementing their rules. Next slide, please. Over the past decade, we have published 22 peer-reviewed scientific journal articles primarily focused on ballast water and biofouling management, and these 22 papers have been cited 952 times in other peer-reviewed papers, clearly showing the impact of our research at advancing the science of invasive species management across the globe. Next slide, please. So today I want to talk about two impactful papers that we've published over the past month, one highlighting the great work of our Marine Invasive Species Program during the first 25 years of our existence, and another globally collaborative paper identifying a potential environmental catastrophe likely to result from the closure of the Strait of Hormuz due to the current war in Iran and the surrounding region. So next slide, please. So this initial paper, focused on the first 25 years of the California Marine Invasive Species Program, was prepared by our commission scientists in collaboration with our program partners at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And I want to take this opportunity to emphasize the important collaboration between the commission and our program partners, not just with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, but also with the State Water Resources Control Board and the Department of Tax and Fee Administration to advance the important work of the Marine Invasive Species Program. So next slide, please. We focused the first part of this paper on the enormous ecological pressures that commercial shipping has placed on the state of California during this 25-year period. In total, almost 250,000 commercial vessels have arrived at California ports during this time, mostly at the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, and ports within the greater San Francisco Bay and Delta region, but also at ports from here in San Diego in the south all the way up to Humboldt Bay in the north. Next slide, please. Together, these vessels have discharged 230 million metric tons of ballast water into California's waters. So that volume is equivalent to nearly 61 billion, with a B, gallons, or 92,000 Olympic-sized swimming pools. Prior to the start of the Marine Invasive Species Program in 2000, this discharged ballast water would not have been managed nor regulated. At the time, billions of live organisms were discharged into California's ports each day. Now all of that discharged ballast water is subject to management requirements, including ballast water treatment that the Commission has been pushing for since 2006, and that now is required at the federal and international levels. And vessels that are discharging ballast water in California ports must report that information to the Commission at each arrival. Next slide, please. These vessels also have an enormous amount of underwater surface area that is susceptible to the accumulation of organisms like barnacles, mussels, tube worms that we collectively refer to as biofouling. We use the underwater surface area of vessels as a proxy for biofouling risk because it represents the potential extent for moving groups of organisms on the hulls of these vessels from one port to another around the globe. During these 25 years, arriving vessels at California ports cumulatively had nearly 3,000 square kilometers of underwater surface area. So that cumulative area is equivalent to about 2.3 times the size of the city of Los Angeles or 24 times the county of San Francisco. To minimize the risk of biofouling species introductions, the Commission adopted biofouling management regulations in 2017 and became the first jurisdiction in the world to require comprehensive vessel biofouling management. And since then, New Zealand, Australia, and Brazil have also implemented similar regulations in their jurisdictions, and the International Maritime Organization is now on a path towards mandatory biofouling management across the globe. Next slide, please. Our paper also describes our effective inspection and outreach program designed to assess whether the vessels are complying with California's ballast water and biofouling management requirements. I want to point out here that our skilled inspectors not only board ships to perform marine invasive species program inspections, but they're also cross-trained to inspect for the Commission's oil spill prevention program. These inspectors are the face of the program, face of the Commission, when interacting with the regulated industry, and they're very effective at what they do. During these 25 years, staff inspected nearly 50,000 vessel arrivals for compliance and provided valuable outreach about our program and the reasons behind the state's requirements. These inspections have resulted in over 5,000 administrative violations, so that's inadequate record keeping or reporting, and nearly 500 operational violations for things like incomplete ballast water management. I want to point out these two charts. The first one shows the consistent number of inspections occurring per year over this 25-year period, and the second one shows the number of operational violations per year. The dashed line there between 2017 and 2018 on the second chart is when we first adopted enforcement regulations that gave us a legal mechanism to enforce on violations with monetary penalties. As you can see, the rate of noncompliance was drastically reduced once we started issuing these penalties in late 2017. I also want to point out the shipping industry's commitment to improving compliance over time. So even before that those enforcement regulations were adopted in 2017, there was a steady decrease in the number of those operational violations going back a few years. Next slide, please. So the take-home result of our paper clearly shows the benefit of our actions during this period, with a threefold reduction in the number of new species detected that were likely introduced via shipping in California waters. It's a success story that we're very proud of and one that we will strive to improve on in the coming years. And I also want to reiterate that our marine invasive species program has moved the needle many times on ballast water and biofouling management, requiring both at a time when neither was required at the federal level. We've also successfully encouraged our federal and international partners to move in the same direction to continually improve how we all work together to protect our shared resources. Next slide, please. So this second peer-reviewed paper resulted from a collaboration with 23 other marine ecologists from countries across the globe, and it was meant to be a clarion call to action to address the serious potential for irreversible environmental damage from the vessels that are currently idled within the Persian Gulf and surrounding region. Next slide, please. So this image shows us the number of oil tankers and other commercial cargo vessels that were stuck in the Persian Gulf and the Gulf of Oman as of August 7th of this year. At the peak, there were 1,500 vessels idled in this region. While the safety of the vessels and their crews is the most important focus right now, we felt it necessary to highlight the environmental risk that these vessels will eventually spread once the strait fully reopens. Next slide, please. The conditions these vessels are experiencing are a perfect recipe for extreme risk of biofouling accumulation. The water in the Persian Gulf is extremely warm, averaging about 40 degrees Celsius or 104 degrees Fahrenheit, and are incredibly productive from a biological standpoint. Elevated temperatures often mean elevated rates of growth and reproduction. All these ships are stationary and have been for over 5 months now, and we do not know when they will leave. Remaining idle is one of the greatest risk factors for biofouling accumulation. These vessels are all parked next to each other as well. So not only are they susceptible to biofouling accumulation from local organisms, but also the organisms already growing on their neighboring ship hulls that have arrived from elsewhere. Even scarier is the fact that the region does not have enough in-water cleaning capacity to clean all of these vessels before they leave. So when these ships are allowed to leave again, most of them will leave with extensive reefs on their hulls, and likely all at once. Next slide, please. So we modeled previous populations of ships in the region to see where the stranded ships are likely to go next, and this figure shows the likely sphere of impact within a month of leaving the Persian Gulf. Ports within this sphere are likely to receive heavily fouled ships and probably do not have the capacity to clean them. So the sphere might be extended beyond this region. Next slide, please. This figure is showing the ports that we expect to be visited within 12 months of leaving, and this includes ports here in California. So hopefully these ships will have been cleaned before they get to us, but the potential exists that we may see one or a few of them. I will note that our biofouling regulations have special provisions built into them for vessels that remain in the same location for 45 days or longer. So any of these vessels that do come to California will have to apply these management measures to reduce risk prior to coming to California. Next slide, please. And we concluded this paper with several high-level recommendations for the shipping industry and global network of ports and regulatory authorities. First and foremost is that these ships should be cleaned as soon as possible. While recognizing that there is insufficient capacity for this to occur in the Persian Gulf, it should be done at a vessel's first port of call if possible, or at subsequent ports of call once a vessel reaches a port with enough capacity for cleaning. Second, the vessel's organizations should make every attempt to quantify the amount of biofouling on their underwater surfaces, and there are a variety of ways for them to do this effectively. We also plan further research forecasting where these vessels are likely to go once they're on the move again, and suggest that early ports of call set up monitoring programs to enable detection of new species introduction so they can respond rapidly. Finally, knowledge dissemination networks are critically important here, and we're glad that this paper was the start of that process, with many large news organizations picking up and sharing these messages. So we're planning additional research to better quantify the risk in the coming months, especially for those ports within the projected initial sphere of impact. Next slide, please. And thank you for your attention, and happy to take some questions.
Thank you very much.
Any questions? No?
How about you?
No? Are you sure? You seem kind of like you might have a
question.
Well,
I don't have a question.
How about
I just,
a statement?
I might have a statement, yes.
All right.
Yes, maybe a statement. No, I appreciate the presentation, and thank you to the staff. I know this is a lot of work, and appreciate SLC staff undertaking some of these reports and sort of really digging into these. I guess my statement is more, maybe it's not a statement of, it's more of a little bit of a concern, probably not unlike what we're already feeling, related to specifically the vessels that we will at maybe some point see coming out of the strait. And, you know, I would hate to see, unfortunately, what looks like such forward progress that we've made here, particularly in our ports, slide backwards. And I know that some of that will likely be out of our control in many ways, but appreciate the staff thinking ahead and, you know, thinking about how, when there are opportunities for us to kind of get in there and sort of assert what we are requiring when they get to at least California, that we make every effort to do so. And I'm sure we will, but just a little concerning, to see it. We already know we're dealing with our little friend, the mussel, and let's, we don't need to bring anything else in. But anyway, thank you. Appreciate all the information. It's very helpful.
Would it be okay to respond really
Absolutely,
quickly?
Absolutely, Chris, go ahead.
Yes. Yeah. So this was a very unique situation, but we did have somewhat similar situations related to the 2008-2009 global financial crisis and the COVID pandemic, where ships stopped operating and just sat idle for months at a time. So in that regard, it's similar, and that actually led to our regulation including those provisions. What's new here is that it's all happening at the same spot in the same location, and they're all about to spread out at the same time. And so the concerning part is there, definitely. I think we're in a good position here in California because we took notice of what happened in 2009 and during the COVID pandemic and put those provisions in place to require management for those vessels that did sit stationary for those long periods. And likely those ships aren't going to get here for 10 to 12 months, and they hopefully would have had many opportunities to be cleaned throughout that process before they get here.
I hope so.
Yeah.
We should just tell them that they don't get to come to us unless they make some stops. So what I'm actually hearing, though, is that, because we are learning, California is just that much in that much better of a position, as I would expect from California. So, all right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Yes, please.
I was just curious, what are the international standards for dealing with marine invasive species? Do we coordinate with other nations to deal with this?
Yes, we coordinate all the time with other countries specific to ballast water and biofouling management. So there are a lot of international regulations in place for ballast water, and there have been for a while. And so we've worked cooperatively with the International Maritime Organization and our federal government and other countries. When it comes to biofouling, there really, at the time we developed our regulations, there wasn't anything else in place other than voluntary guidelines. And so we worked very closely with other countries that were going through similar processes at the same time. So New Zealand, Australia primarily, and Canada, because Canada and New Zealand were leading the International Maritime Organization process. So we worked a lot with them, leaned heavily on their experience and what they were proposing and talking about at the International Maritime Organization, which is an agency of the United Nations. So there's a lot of participation there, also from the shipping industry, a lot to learn from them about what they were doing. So all of that information came into us, and we used that to help inform the development of our regulations that we started in 2008, but we didn't finish until 2017. So we took a good decade to collect information and get it right.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Mr. Chris Ciani. Appreciate your presentation. Let's take public comment on item 52.
There are no hands raised.
All right. Are there anyone in the chamber today? All right, seeing none. Commissioners, do you have any comments? Well, you already made your comments and questions. May I have a motion to adopt the staff's recommendation and a second?
This item and the next item are actually informational.
Oh, so okay.
No vote needed for this one.
All right, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Let's go ahead to item 53. It's a presentation by staff on the Recon Island and beyond. Wow, what a title. A retrospective on a decade of challenges, milestones, and the Commission's evolving approach to offshore mineral management. Woo! Yes. Can we have the staff presentation, please?
Thank you so much, Madam Chair. Yes, good afternoon. My name is Joe Fable. I'm a senior attorney here at the State Lands Commission, and it is my pleasure today to present this retrospective on a transformative decade, really for the Commission with regards to offshore mineral management. In the decade since August 2016, the Commission really has faced numerous challenges: operator insolvencies, complex multi-state litigation, and really threats to the financial structure which underlines state leases. But each time those challenges were met, this Commission stepped into the breach, taking over operations that were deserted, prosecuting and defending the state's rights in various jurisdictions, and changing the laws to better protect the people of California. And the results today really are, 10 years later, it's a more transparent, accountable, and resilient model of stewardship for state sovereign lands. Next slide, please. So since 2016, the Commission has successfully exercised its authority to protect the state and the environment. And those two examples are best illustrated by Rincon Island and Platform Holly in the South Elwood Project. Next slide, please. Now, 10 years ago this month, in August 2016, the Commission, for the first time in its history, was considering whether or not to terminate oil and gas leases off Rincon Island for operator compliance issues. Now, just 2 days before that hearing, the operator at the time, Rincon Island Limited Partnership, declared bankruptcy in a Dallas bankruptcy court, totally upending that process. Now, instead of letting the bankruptcy process play out like we may have over the prior decades, Commission leadership directed staff to directly intervene in that process, claw back those leases, enter the property, and make sure that it was taken over by the state to ensure environmental and safety compliance. Next slide, please. And that's exactly what we did. So Commission staff, with the help of the Department of Attorney General's Office in counsel in Texas, went to court through numerous hearings over the next year in an adversarial process, convinced the court to require Rincon Island Limited Partnership to surrender the leases back to the state. And this was in the face of secured creditors demanding compensation and attempting to get these leases assigned to a new operator. In 2017, again, the Commission prevailed. These leases were quitclaim back to the state, and then the hard work began, the technically difficult process of plugging 70 wells, clearing the island, and doing so in a responsible fashion. Next slide, please. Yes, yeah, so this is Rincon Island located off Muscle Shoals. This is before the work from the state occurred. At the bottom.
Ventura County.
Thank you.
Ventura County. Thank you.
Please, where is it on the map?
Oh, no worries.
Sir?
No worries. My apologies.
I've been there.
You have, indeed.
Okay.
Looked a little better when you were there. Next slide, please. And this, of course, is an after picture, but that plug and abandonment work took about 2.5 years, completely undertaken by the state of California, and what was the largest project undertaken by this agency at that time. Again, 70 wells completed late 21. It was all done on time and under budget with no operational upsets. This was conducted with money provided by the legislature and, of course, the support of the administration. Now, after that, as the commission no doubt recalls, in 2024, it approved, an EIR for the future decommissioning of the Rincon Island and an onshore facility. That process went through a massive stakeholder discussion with community input on what the outcome should be. 2025 also, the commission likely recalls, that it engaged in a first-of-its-kind MOU with the Coastal Band of the Chumash Tribal Nation for a future co-management agreement of this property post-decommissioning. That decommissioning and solicitation for it was approved also in 2025, and the work for it is set to begin in 2027. Next slide, please. Now, in the midst of battling over Rincon Island, another crisis brewed. In April 2017, off Santa Barbara Coast, off the city of Goleta, an operator for a state lease, Venico, quit-claimed its leases and gave us 2 weeks' notice that it was deserting its facilities both offshore and an onshore facility called the Elwood Onshore Facility. Now, those facilities required 24/7 staffing in order to control and treat hydrogen sulfide laden gas, which was absolutely a threat to the community. This was a known quantity out there. But the commission took decisive action, entered those properties to eliminate the present threat, and again started a process of staffing. Next slide. Again, working with the legislature and the administration, the commission obtained funding to operate those facilities, negotiated agreements with ExxonMobil to conduct the plugging of the 30 wells and eventual decommissioning, also worked with the community to facilitate that work. The platform's wells were plugged in 2024. In late 2023, this commission was able to report that the hydrogen sulfide emergency was ended, thus containing the situation. And now the facility awaits final decommissioning after an EIR likely to be presented in 2027. Next slide. In an associated project, this commission likely recalls, in 2023, two oil piers were decommissioned off Haskell's Beach. These were the last remnants of oil production in this area that originally started in 1928. This work was again undertaken by the commission, occurred in very difficult tidal conditions, and occurred without upset and on time. Next slide, please. Additional projects that the commission has undertaken over the last 10 years included varieties of aspects tied to lease compliance. The biggest one here, in 2019, the commission did take action to finally terminate an oil and gas lease. This was associated with production off Santa Barbara, the Corone leases, and the Signal Hill pipeline that ties to the offshore federal platforms Houchin and Hogan. This was for failure to pay rent and also failure to produce under their leases. Once the commission took this action, though, it did have that drawn effect of expediting the future decommissioning of those two federal platforms. So that was a direct action by the commission. The Legacy Well Program started originally back in the 90s, but in 2016 kicked off again with the plugging of Becker Well. This is off Summerlin Beach in Ventura County, plugging of legacy wells, which are generally 100-year-old wells with no known operators. Thanks to the work of commission staff and those in the community, we are able to pass a funding bill, SB 44, so that we can continue that work. And now we have 9 wells that have been plugged under that program. And finally, Esther. I know this commission no doubt again recalls that it entered into an improved legal settlement with DCOR, an operator, that results in the early decommissioning of Platform Esther offshore Seal Beach. settlement converted a contested operational dispute to an enforceable retirement plan and returned lease acreage to the California Coastal Sanctuary. Next slide, please. So since 2016, the Commission's defended the state's rights and secured consequential legal victories. And in each one of these, the Commission was successful. In Ray Rincon Island, again, this was the Dallas Bankruptcy Court. Big aspects of this is the state recovered quite a bit of money out of bankruptcy. We received about a $9.6 million bond from Rincon Island Limited Partnership that was contested, entered into an $8 million settlement with prior operators that had very limited liability. But the really big aspect of this is, again, we convinced both the bankruptcy court and secured lenders that really it made no sense to continue this operation. The juice was not worth the squeeze, and that it made more sense to return back to the state so that, again, it could protect the people of the state of California. State Lands Commission versus Plains All-American, probably the greatest one in my mind. This is the brainchild of our chief counsel, Seth Blackman. This one was where we, State Lands Commission, sued Plains All-American for recovery of monies that we paid into Platform Holly due to the 2015 Refugio spill, which really the knock-on effects caused the Holly issue. Pardon me. This one was amazing because it created new law. At the time, Plains was protected as a public utility, and it had public utility exemptions from liability. Seth and a crack team from the Office of the Attorney General did not agree, went into court, and through the appeals process, changed the law. So in the appeals court, upheld by the California Supreme Court, the public utility exemption was held not to apply to Plains and similarly situated operators. What that allowed the State Lands Commission to do through a fairly divisive discovery battle and further motion practice is get a record-breaking settlement, $50.5 million. Again, that is essentially what the commission was seeking. That covered a majority, vast majority of the costs paid into the Holly project. So great victory there. Davis versus SLC, this was a situation the EOF, Platform Holly, where the trustee for the Venico estate still owned this onshore facility necessary to treat the H2S gas. Well, they felt they needed, State Lands Commission needed to pay rent for the opportunity to address the problem that they created. And so in October 2018, they sued the State Lands Commission versus condemnation, sought $165 million. Commission, of course, said no and disagreed. Through a five-day trial in February of 2022, the commission prevailed in full. The court at that time found that the commission's actions of entering onto the EOF to protect the community was an exemplary use of its police powers. Again, that creates a situation where the commission knows that in certain situations it can enter its lands to make the situation safe. And finally, SLC versus Signal Hill. This is after the 2019 breach. Again, the commission sued on principle. It was owed money for rent, and that's what it sought. So this is a brass tacks, nut and bolt breach of contract and trespass case, but we prevailed. We pursued Signal Hill to a Wyoming bankruptcy court, and at that point, we're very close to recovering those monies as well. Next slide, please. Finally here, since 2016, the commission reformed its process to protect the state from future liabilities. Back in 2017, in the midst of Rincon, in the midst of Holly, there was a situation where CRC, a responsible operator out of Huntington Beach, sought a royalty rate adjustment. The commission staff and the commission used that opportunity to vastly amend their leases to ensure that the state was covered in the event of a future default. So we developed all sorts of interesting aspects. We developed a sinking fund where CRC pays into it each year to cover future payment obligations. Early plug and abandonment of idle wells. Under a mandatory program, CRC has plugged 100 idle wells out there, reducing the future potential for liability. Another aspect is that we have obtained a first of its kind, and a very good aspect, a secured interest in upland properties that can also go towards decommissioning. And finally, there are regular cost assessments, so everyone knows what the final decommissioning obligations are, and we know to the degree of what delta, if any, we need to cross. AB 585, a bill that the commission sponsored, amended the Public Resources Code and gave the commission more tools when assessing assignments of oil and gas leases. This is huge, because prior to this, we really could not legally assess, hey, operator's history of compliance, wherewithal to handle decommissioning obligations. Now the commission absolutely can assess that. Additionally, operators that assign a lease are forever responsible for those decommissioning obligations as well. So again, that helps prevent future situations. AB 2257, real briefly, again, this was a data-driven assessment where the commission was funded to assess decommissioning liabilities of all leases, also the cost to the degree the state wanted to buy out the interests of those oil operators to assist in potential negotiations in that regards. SB 1425, that ties to the Long Beach unit, an oil operation out of Long Beach, which the state receives a lot of money. However, the state also has a lot of decommissioning obligations. It was underfunded to the tune of $600 million. But now, due to monthly increases, the state is on track to fully meeting its decommissioning obligation by the time that field is no longer economically producible. And then finally, SB 44, where the commission receives $2 million a year in order to plug legacy wells off Summerlin Beach and other areas. Next slide, please. And finally, sometimes it's not about the journey. It's about the friends you make along the way. And the commission absolutely has formed durable partnerships throughout this entire process with the state CalGEM, Coastal Commission, Water Boards, has been with us every step of the way on all these projects. The legislature has been tremendously helpful. Pro Tem Limon, Assemblymember Hart, their offices and their staff have been incredibly responsive and helpful in these aspects. And, of course, both the Brown and Newsom administration. Cannot say enough for the Santa Barbara County, Ventura County. Every level of their county's planning, fire has been involved on these decommissioning projects. And of course, our friends in the NGOs. Heliocean was essential in getting SB 44 passed. Environmental Defense Center has been supportive of every aspect of our decommissioning program, informs their members, builds support, which makes our job easier in undertaking these projects. Same with Get Oil Out. Next slide. And finally, I promise, here are the durable results. Since 2016, well, I should say, this last decade has seen the largest contraction of offshore mineral interest rates in state's history. 37 square miles have been returned to California Coastal Sanctuary. Five offshore oil platforms have been closed. There's only two remaining, the fewest since the 1950s in state waters. We have seen the largest projects undertaken in commission history. We have seen the largest recoveries in commission history. We have seen the largest agreements through the Phase 1 and Phase 2 agreements with Exxon. Again, this has been monumental in how we have approached every aspect of oil and gas production. And there's more work to come. Again, we still have to go and decommission Rincon Island, Platform Holly. There's more to work to proceed as we plan for Esther in every aspect. So through this, we are better situated than we were in August 2016. And this entire process has taken place with employees across every division of this agency. And I can say that we have conducted this with pride, no doubt, as the commission has as well. We look forward to the future. With that, next slide. Take any questions.
Well, you've been busy. Thank you for that report. We appreciate that. And I think the title, your presentation lived up to the title. So I'm grateful. Let me see if my colleagues have any questions or statements. Yes?
You know me with my statements.
Yes.
Today. Actually, there is a little bit of an embedded question, and perhaps it's just that I don't know where to find this, but I think this report shows, to the chair's point, a ton of work. And I think it's a ton of work that has been undertaken across, obviously, several administrations. But we know specifically the last administrations have been very focused on how do we move forward in this space with decommissioning and also looking towards more environmentally sustainable methods of sort of supporting what all of our needs that we have across the state. So I'm wondering, two questions maybe, and maybe this is more for Dr. Dumlau, but have we shared this with the governor's office? Because if not, I think it might be nice to do so.
We have not.
Okay. I just think, and perhaps if you could share the PowerPoint with us, that would be helpful. But I think this is something, again, a priority for particularly, obviously, this administration and past administrations. And I think they always like to see some of the data. So fantastic job, team. Thank you.
right, great. Thank you. All right, let's see if there's any public comment on this informational item.
No one signed up to speak for this item.
All right, thank you. Well, then we will just keep moving on. Sherry, you're up. Okay, item 54 is an update on the state lands legislation relevant to the California State Lands Commission. We have a staff presentation by, of course, Sherry Pemberton.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners.
Can you just turn your mic on?
So sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioners. Apologies for not turning the mic on. This is an informational update. There's no action associated with this item. It's an informational update on the 2026 legislative year. There's 6 days between now and the end of session, so we don't know the full realm of results from this year until the legislature adjourns this coming Monday. So this update reflects legislation that staff has tracked, sponsored, or engaged in over this past year, and no legislation or amendments that may surface in the next week. The Commission sponsored one bill this year, SB 1428, to update regulatory references associated with our marine invasive species program. This was a pretty straightforward technical cleanup bill and was included in the Senate Natural Resources and Water Committee bill. And the governor signed that earlier this year. The Commission did not take a formal support or opposition position on legislation this year, but did direct staff to work this past summer with Assemblymember Hart's office and sponsors on AB 1448 by Assemblymember Hart, which is legislation to address the federal government's efforts to expand offshore oil and gas development in California. AB 1448 requires the Commission to consider additional factors before approving or denying an offshore oil and gas lease assignment, including the proposed assignee's history of oil spills, confirmation of a bond sufficient to pay decommissioning costs, and a proposed assignee's ability to protect the state's public trust resources and values. The bill also makes consideration of these factors a requirement, changing may to shall. The bill also changes the Commission's authority to issue a new offshore oil and gas lease if the state's oil resources are being drained from adjacent federal operations. Although the legislature banned new offshore oil and gas leases in 1994, it preserved the Commission's authority to enter into leases for drainage. AB 1448 modifies that authority by excluding marine protected areas or national marine sanctuaries. The final thing AB 1448 does is to ban using existing leases or infrastructure to support new offshore oil and gas development in federal waters. And staff has worked with the author's office and the sponsors Oceana, the Center for Biological Diversity, and the Environmental Defense Center on the language, and the current version of the bill reflects our work. The bill, however, remains on the Senate floor, and we don't know yet if it will make its way to the governor's desk before the legislature adjourns. Another bill I wanted to highlight is AB 2312 by Assemblymember Farias. This bill addresses the city of Martinez's marina and waterfront, both of which are in relative disrepair and in need of revitalization. The marina and waterfront are on public trust lands that the commission oversees. AB 2312 authorizes a longer lease term for waterfront lands in the city, up to 66 years from the current 49 years, and an even longer lease term if approved by the commission. And this bill passed with unanimous support and is on the governor's desk. These are the two most noteworthy bills, or three most noteworthy bills, from this year in terms of the State Lands Commission. There were many other bills introduced that could ancillarily affect the commission's work, some of which were held for fiscal or other reasons over this past year, including bills to embed California's 30 by 30 land conservation goal into funding decisions and prevent invasive species introductions, including the golden mussel. Bills that are moving to the governor's desk include a bill that would benefit the marine environment by banning false environmental advertising and sunscreens, a bill to create a coastal resilience permitting working group, of which the commission would be a member, a bill to require health-based threshold levels for hydrogen sulfide to improve air quality in southern San Diego, particularly to regions affected by the Tijuana River transboundary pollution crisis, and legislation to establish an Outdoors for All initiative to advance equitable access to nature. So that's kind of a summary of where we are. Looking ahead, we'll continue monitoring legislation and developments over this next week and report back in October, and then we'll start transitioning to looking at legislative concepts for 2027. And that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer questions.
I do have some questions. It's more on your approach and how you're tracking legislation. Do you look at different committee agenda items and look for items that we're in, that we are vested and interested in? Do you watch online? Do you go in person? Do you also meet with members for and against?
Yes.
Or perhaps even some that are on the fence as to whether or not to support a piece of legislation? And then the other part of the question is, I'm going to assume the answer, but I want to hear it from you on the record, is the approach is not as a nonpartisan approach, right? You are talking to all members of the legislature.
Yes. Let me go back to your questions from the beginning. We do a combination of we have a combination of ways that we monitor and track.
Or is it just you?
It's just me, but I do work with all of our programs, with our divisions, our environmental management and planning division, our legal division, our mineral resources division, our marine environmental protection division. I track all the bills. We have a program called Capital Track that we use to tag bills that we think the commission might be interested in or affect the commission. We do look at all the agendas for the committees where the bills of interest to the commission usually fall. Senate Natural Resources and Water Committee, Assembly Natural Resources Committee are the primary two policy committees. And then the Environmental Safety and Toxics Committee and Environmental Quality Committee on the Senate side have fewer bills, but some bills that may be of interest to the commission. So I follow the committee hearings. Don't always go in person unless there's a bill that the commission's directed staff to engage in or take a position on. And in that instance, I would then speak in favor or provide remarks on behalf of the commission. We also provide technical assistance to committee staff and member staff on questions related to bills that are moving through the legislature that other members have introduced or that may be of interest to the commission.
Okay, thank you. No. All right, that's it. Thank you very much.
Okay.
We appreciate your time and your expertise.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go ahead to public comment. Is there any member of the public that'd like to comment on this?
The first speaker is Lisa Gilfillan in person.
All right. Welcome. I think you're... It's good to see you.
Yes, good to see you again. Sorry about signing up for your public comment. Here I am for this item. I'm here... I really appreciate the summary that just occurred here because I just wanted to come up here and say thank you, quite frankly. Oceana is a proud sponsor of AB 1448, and we greatly appreciate the work the commission staff has done with us, with Assemblymember Hart's office, and our fellow sponsors to strengthen and refine this legislation. The commission's expertise is incredibly important in making sure that the protections we're pursuing are not only strong, but workable, aligned, and highly effective. We genuinely appreciate the time, the collaboration, and the thoughtful engagement with the staff that's been brought to this process. I had my headphones in, sitting in the back corner, because AB 1448 is being heard right now on the Senate floor, so I'm kind of creeping in the back, listening in on what's happening on the Senate floor. Hasn't been heard yet, so I have no updates, no breaking news. But it's moving towards the finish line. It'll be heard in the Senate, it'll move back to the Assembly for concurrence, and then on to the governor's desk. So we're just truly grateful for the partnership that's happened throughout, and we're looking forward to seeing how this partnership will pay off in the end with all this effort and hopefully a final signature soon. So thank you all.
Sounds good. Thanks for that positive uplift. Are there any other members of the public that'd like to speak on this item?
There are no more speakers.
There are no more. Thank you very much. All right. All right. All right, we're going to go to item number 55, which relates to an assignment of 4 leases for the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines associated with the Santa Ynez unit offshore Santa Barbara County. There will be no staff presentation or action to be taken on this item, but we will hear public comments. So I'd like to open up for public comments at this time.
There are no public comments.
None at all? Okay. Well, we'll move on. Dr. Dumlau, what's next in the order of business?
Yes, the next item is item 43. This is the item we pulled from the consent calendar. Mm-hmm. and that the staff presentation will be made by Jeff Plavnik.
Great. Welcome back, Jeff.
Thank you very much.
Oh, ready when you are.
I'm just waiting. There we go.
All right.
All right. Good afternoon, Madam Chair and Commissioners. I'm Jeff Plavnik, Granted Land Specialist with the Land Management Division, and I'm here to present on item 43. Next slide, please. This item concerns state sovereign lands that have been legislatively granted to the City of Newport Beach. The aerial imagery here depicts all of the city's granted lands, but the item at hand is only concerned with a small portion of these lands. To provide some background, the legislature originally granted the state's sovereign lands in Newport Bay to the City of Newport Beach in 1919. Then, in the 1920s, several parcels of tide and submerged lands in the bay were filled as part of an improvement plan that included harbor development. The original 1919 grant was amended several times before being repealed and replaced in 1978 by the operative grant, Chapter 74, Statutes of 1978. Chapter 74 re-granted to the city all tide and submerged lands, whether filled or unfilled, in both the Pacific Ocean and Newport Bay within the city's boundaries to hold and manage in trust. Chapter 74 also addressed three parcels that had been filled as part of the harbor development in the 20s. Chapter 74 identified these three filled parcels as parcels A, B, and C, and it also included specific findings and provisions that addressed the filled and reclaimed nature of these parcels. However, Chapter 74 failed to recognize a fourth parcel that had also been filled during harbor development in the 20s. Next slide, please. This fourth parcel, which is now known as Parcel D, along with the adjoining property, was leased by the city to a private entity in 1948 for a term of 50 years. When this lease was signed, the character of Parcel D and the adjoining lands had not yet been resolved, and under its leasehold interest, the city's lessee developed Parcel D and the adjacent property with a residential apartment complex and a private social club. It wasn't until 1952, after this development had occurred, that a judicial determination confirmed Parcel D as tide and submerged lands and thus part of the city's grant. Although the parcel was determined to be public trust lands at this time, it was already subject to a 50-year lease that included residential uses which had already been developed. Therefore, although inconsistent with the public trust doctrine, this residential use was allowed to continue. Finally, in 1994, the legislature addressed the residential use on Parcel D via Chapter 728, Statutes of 1994. Parcel D and the adjoining properties are depicted on the aerial imagery here outlined in yellow. Today, Balboa Bay Club Ventures LLC is successor to the 1948 lease that included Parcel D. A residential apartment complex still remains on Parcel D, and it continues to be leased under a single lease that includes the adjoining properties, with the adjoining properties now hosting a resort hotel, private yacht and social club, marina, restaurant, and a variety of other recreational and visitor-serving facilities. These other facilities are also owned and operated by Balboa Bay Club Ventures. Next slide, please. So as mentioned, the legislature addressed residential uses on Parcel D through Chapter 728, Statutes of 1994. Chapter 728 specifically allowed the non-conforming residential use on Parcel D to continue until the residential improvement reached the end of its useful life, but in no event beyond December 31st, 2044. It also required that the city deposit a share of the revenue it receives for any lease that includes Parcel D into the Capiloff Land Bank Fund, with the remainder of the revenue being deposited into the city's Tidelands Fund. Finally, Chapter 728 provided that the form of any future lease or amendment of the lease involving Parcel D and the consideration to be received by the city shall be subject to approval by the State Lands Commission. The city and Balboa Bay Club Ventures recently negotiated a second amended and restated ground lease that includes Parcel D. Consistent with Chapter 728, the city has requested commission approval of the form and consideration of this lease. Next slide, please. In seeking approval pursuant to Chapter 728, the city consulted with staff regarding the form of the lease and its consideration. The city worked with staff to develop the lease's language, and a few important aspects of the new lease are listed here. Overall, the proposed lease updates the lease language to be consistent with modern requirements, thereby ensuring that both lessee and lessor obligations align with current laws and best practices. The new lease also establishes a new 50-year term, which is consistent with the maximum lease term that the city can provide under its granting statutes, but does also extend the lease well beyond the December 31st, 2044 sunset date for residential uses on Parcel D. To address this, the lease acknowledges that the lessee intends to work towards obtaining legislative extension for these uses, but also requires the city and the lessee to proactively establish public trust consistent uses on the parcel if such an extension is not obtained. Next slide, please. As for the lease's consideration, this is broken down into two types of rent, with the lessee paying whichever of these is greater each year. The first type of rent under the lease is base rent. Under the new lease, base rent will start at $3,921,732.76 per year and was calculated by adjusting the annual base rent from the previous lease. The lease also provides that base rent will be adjusted every 5 years to a sum equal to 75% of the average annual rent paid over the preceding 5-year period. Additionally, the base rent will be adjusted by an appraisal at the 19th anniversary of the lease to confirm that it is consistent with market value. Next slide, please. The second type of rent used as consideration for the new lease is percentage rent. Percentage rent for the lease will be equal to the total specific percentages of gross revenues for the lessee's various revenue-generating activities, as shown here. As mentioned earlier, the lease provides that consideration will be the greater of base rent or percentage rent each year. Thus, in general, it is expected that the lessee will pay percentage rent, with base rent only being paid during years when the lessee faces financial decline. Combined with the regular adjustments to base rent, this ensures that, barring extended economic downturn, the base rent will escalate over time and both types of rent will keep pace with changes in market rates for uses on the lease premises. Next slide, please. Staff's analysis indicates that the lease language is reasonable, complies with the requirements of the city's granting statutes, and ensures that the existing non-conforming uses on Parcel D will be discontinued in favor of uses consistent with the public trust doctrine unless the legislature chooses to extend the permitted term for the non-conforming uses. Staff's analysis also concludes that because consideration is the greater of base rent or percentage rent, it ensures fair compensation for the authorized uses on granted lands. And due to how the regular base rent adjustments will be calculated, the base rent can be expected to escalate over time, with both base rent and percentage rent adjusting to keep pace with changing market conditions over the term of the lease. Next slide, please. Therefore, staff believes that both the lease's form and consideration are acceptable and recommend that, pursuant to Chapter 728, Statutes of 1994, the Commission approve the form and consideration of the proposed second amended and restated ground lease between the City of Newport Beach and Balboa Bay Club Ventures, LLC. Next slide, please. Thank you. That concludes staff's presentation. Staff is available to answer any questions you might have.
All right. Thank you very much for the presentation. Any questions, any concerns? All right. It's a pretty thorough presentation. There are no questions. Thank you very much. Let's go ahead and go to public comment on this item.
The first speaker will be Adam Laverenz in person.
All right. Hi, Adam.
Good afternoon again. I have a couple slides, please. And I'd ask, do I get 3 minutes or 2 minutes?
That's a good question. What do we start off with? 2 minutes.
Okay. Usually agenda items get three.
That's not true. Well, it's between two and three.
Okay. Well, at the discretion of the chair, I apologize. this first slide here is a timeline, which Mr. Plovnik just gave you very clearly, so we could move to the second slide. As was noted, this began in 1948. Things were clearly different back then as they are now. This lease would extend the non-conforming, inconsistent use to 128 years on the site. And I'm not generally in favor of removing any form of housing in the coastal zone, even if it's non-compliant. But the problems I have here is Mr. Plovnik mentions that this is consistent with the granting statute. It says that for uses consistent with the trust, not exceeding 50 years, and staff identifies this as a non-conforming use inconsistent with the trust. And again, applying the same standard to a non-conforming inconsistent use that is legislatively granted to a public trust-related use, I think in error. We haven't found anywhere in the statutes of 1978 or 1994 any indication of allowable lease terms for non-conforming public trust inconsistent uses. One has to presume that the legislative intent was that leases for purposes consistent with the trust may run to 50 years. Do you as commissioners think the legislature also intended the same exact benefit for non-conforming public trust inconsistent uses? Would doing so even make sense? I pose to you that the only lease that might comply with the granting statutes is the single 25-year lease from 1986. And although the state statute doesn't define lease terms for inconsistent uses, I think the presumption that non-conforming uses get the same benefit as consistent uses is an error. If you continue this lease for 18 years, that gives the applicant, or till 2044 as is legislatively permitted, that gives them 18 years to work with the legislature. And giving one type of leaseholder terms that exceed and don't conform with the public trust, while at the same time the city and the analyst are trying to take away public trust consist use from others, so that's a bad precedent, and I hate to see you go down that road. Thank you.
Thank you. So you did it. 2 minutes. All right. Are there any other members of the public that would like to speak on this item?
There are no more speakers for this item.
All right. You're just moving along here. All right. Well, I think we've come to that special point in our...
We'll have to take a vote on that one.
Oh, okay. Let's take a vote. This is for item number 43?
43.
May I take a motion? Is there a motion and a second to adopt the staff recommendation?
Move to approve.
Second.
All right. A motion has been made, and it has been seconded. And I think we could take that. Same house, same call. Without objection, the motion passes unanimously. All right. Our next item. Well, Nadia, I think that concludes our second public comment period. Is that correct?
All right. Correct.
Thank you very much.
Do we have any speakers who signed up for the second public comment period?
I was indicated no, but let me check.
Okay.
I just confirmed and we have no speakers signed up for a second.
All right.
Looks like there's a hand on Zoom up.
Thank you. Yes, we do have a hand raised on Zoom if we can take that.
Of course.
Graham Martin Sataro, please unmute yourself and begin your comment.
Thank you.
Sorry, this was about my prior public comment. I didn't quite get to finish. Is it possible to say something?
Or
is it specific?
No, not at this time. We've moved on.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay.
We have no other hand raised for comment at this time.
All right. Thank you. Commissioners, any questions or comments or anything? We're going to move on. Okay. Dr. Dumlao, what's on the next order of business?
The next order of business is closed session.
All right. Thank you very much.
I have a little bit to read. Informational item 55 on the regular calendar, Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, allows a state body to discuss real property negotiations in closed session, provided that before the closed session, the state body in open session identifies the real property concerned and the person or persons with whom the negotiator may negotiate. In accordance with this requirements, I announce that the Commission will conference in closed session with its real property negotiators regarding the following item. Informational item 55 addresses four applications for assignment of leases governing the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines traversing state waters associated with the Santa Ynez unit in federal waters, including the Elwood Pier, the two mooring buoys, offshore Santa Barbara County. Negotiating parties, State Lands Commission, ExxonMobil, Pacific Offshore Pipeline Company, and Sable Offshore Corp. Under negotiation, price and terms, lease numbers PRC 4977, PRC 5515, PRC 6371, and PRC 7163. And closed session will be held across the hall.
All right. Thank you. We're going to adjourn to closed session. Good afternoon. It's 4:08. I'd like to come back into open session. I call this meeting back into order.
Dr. Dumlau, is there anything to report from the closed session?
Yes, Madam Chair. Pursuant to Government Code Section 11126, Subdivision C7, the Commission met in closed session regarding applications for the assignment of 4 leases governing the use of existing offshore oil and gas pipelines traversing state waters associated with the Santa Ynez unit in federal waters, the Elwood Pier, and 2 mooring buoys offshore Santa Barbara County.
Well, thank you very much. Do any of the commissioners have any comments or questions? None? All right. Thank you. This concludes our meeting. We are adjourned.